And you mentioned the benefits cliff. Can you explain for our listeners what that is and what that means?
Right. So the benefits cliff is the point at which you make too much money to receive any state benefits. So that comes out to about $12 or $13 an hour. And so if we were to raise the wage to those, these people would actually get a net loss in income. And so that's something that happens with a lot of people where they can't work any harder because they actually lose money out of the deal. So it stifles people from even moving up.
But a $15 an hour minimum wage would counter that benefits cliff?
Yes, it would. It would result in a net benefit for Oregonians. Right now, there's something like 400,000 Oregonians making low-wage jobs, and so that would have a huge impact. I was doing a little research the other day, and that's 10% of all Oregonians are making poverty wages.
And what does that mean to make poverty wages in the state of Oregon?
That means we're not entering the economy. That means we're not fixing our cars, and we should be getting basic oil maintenance, stuff like that. Worrying about rent, not being able to take a day off, and fear that we're either going to lose our job or not be able to pay our bills.
One of the arguments made on the right is that people can pull themselves up out of poverty through hard work. What has been your experience, and what do you make of this argument?
I would like to see them show me where this is capable in this economy in any easy form of the sense. I work with a lot of people in the food service industry, and many of them work 2-3 jobs, working 80 to 100 hours a week just to pay their bills, because every single job is making 9.25 to 10 something an hour max. It's very hard to get ahead in this world right now from the bottom, because if you're working 80 hours a week, how are you supposed to be able to find the time to go get a job that maybe pays 13 or 14 an hour? Or, you know, if you got to take time off, it's very hard when you're working 3 jobs. But it's very difficult to move up in this world right now.
So you now are going back to school. And how is that? Is it difficult to both hold a job and be a student at the same time as you try to work towards a degree?
It is. I thought I could work 32 hours a week and go to school full time, which is 12 credits or more, roughly 3 or 4 classes. And I can't do it. I have to work the minimum that I can, which is 20 hours a week, just so I can get my food stamp benefits, which is a funny thing that as I'm going to school full time, I'm told that I have to work 20 hours a week to get food stamps. But the people who aren't going to school don't have to be working to get food stamps. And I'm not saying anything negative about that. I'm just saying it's funny that people who are trying to get a degree and, you know, move up in this world are put at a higher standard. So now I'm doing 30 hours a week in school, 20 hours a week in my work, and I don't have the time to do the other things that I need to get done in life. But so I'm always on the fringe. Like I'm fortunate with the situation where I'm living, to where the money that I get from school, I'm able to spend on my rent for 3 months at a time. But that's not everybody. A lot of people are still working 35, 40 hours a week and going to school part-time, which means that they're taking 6 or 7 years to complete a 4-year degree.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The time is 6:03, and you're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Coming up next is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30 and Hard Knock Radio at 7. Stay tuned.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a 2-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Fernando Gapacin on KBOO Portland. 90.7. This is KBOO Labor Radio, of, by, and for the working class. Your hosts on the second Monday of Labor Radio are myself, Fernando Gapacin, and Elizabeth Ann McDonald. Ann is busy in the state capitol at hearings, advocating for a raise in minimum wage to $15 an hour. That's why she isn't here this evening. But we have a guest tonight. His name is Pete Hybertson. He's a working graduate student at Portland State University. He grew up in the ClintonSpawn.com generation with certain expectations that were crushed by the collapse of 2008 and the realities of our modern capitalist economy. He was largely politicized by the Occupy movement. We've asked him to come onto the show tonight to share a story about how personal tragedy illustrates problems with capitalism and to discuss sources of hope. And we're glad to have you on tonight, Pete.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm going to start out with some leading questions and, mm-hmm. and allow you just to explain your story. I wanted to ask you, do you consider yourself working class?
That's kind of a tough question to answer in a way, I think, because class is about two things, if you ask me. That it's about your material reality, your economic reality, but it's also cultural. You know, it's about what type of community do you grow up in? You know, what kind of access do you have to education? So my answer to your question is kind of yes and no. I certainly grew up middle to upper middle class, and, you know, I think I sound like it, and I think, you know, people can tell that about me. But also, you know, my personal material reality since the economic crash has been more of a working class one. So,
as you grew up, were you concerned about issues like shelter, hunger, education, or healthcare?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. Definitely, as I said, grew up in a pretty privileged set of circumstances, and those calculations that millions of people are needing to make every day about, well, do we buy groceries or do we pay our power bill? Do we pay for these medications or do we keep our phones on? Those sorts of compromises were not just simply not my reality as a child and as a teenager and as a college student.
So things have changed for you. Would you like to explain?
Well, I'm 30 years old now, and I got out of school in September of 2008. As it turns out, here I am literally sitting in the airport, you know, to go back to get things started in the so-called real world. And I see on the televisions in the airport that banks are failing, you know, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. I'm not going to claim I knew that was as hugely significant and destructive as we found out over the next few days that it would be. But I feel as though, like, it was that literal that, you know, I had just finished doing what people of my background were told we were supposed to do. And then the rug had just been suddenly jerked out from underneath us. And suddenly we, you know, just plunged into this, you know, so-called great recession. And the expectations of people who grew up like I did just weren't holding water anymore. It was overnight almost, like a completely different world out there.
So how'd you get to Portland?
Oh, I came out here shortly after all that happened. I grew up in the New York area, so I was looking for a lower cost of living. some friends, and it seemed like the sort of ethos of this town would be a place I enjoy. And I think a lot of that, to some extent, was about its sort of progressive to leftish nature. And, you know, I've been out here for 6 years now and, you know, bounced around sort of from slum ward to slum ward and been working to get by on, you know, not very well-paying jobs. My last job before I went back to school, as you mentioned, was I was working in a supervisory position, 28 hours a week at $13.50 an hour, which works out to be about exactly as much as a full-time minimum wage worker would make. So it's been, you know, it's been a struggle to make a go in this town for me and for a lot of people I've met or that I know. And the story that you mentioned at the beginning of this, to me, just is the most intense example of, you know, sort of the struggle that a lot of the sort of young people who've come here or have grown up here are going through right now.
I know that one of the issues, people your age, one of the ways that they make it is by sharing housing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it might be a difficult thing to talk about, but would you like to talk about your friend Jessica?
That's pretty much what I'm here for, because she deserves, I think, to have her story told. Jessica was my roommate for nearly 4 years until January of this year. And we were holding on to, I think, one of the few relatively affordable two bedrooms in inner southeast Portland at that time. But what happened in that first week of January of this year was that Jessica died suddenly. Suddenly to me, but over the course of a couple days, she died. And she had been coping with a autoimmune disease, which was having a number of effects on her health and her ability to be self-sufficient and get around. She was not able to drive anymore because of this, and she was commuting 2 hours each way from Southeast Portland to Clackamas on TriMet with a lot of walking for someone who didn't have much sensation in her legs and got fatigued extremely easily. So she was just working herself into the ground because she had been going around to a lot of doctors and racking up medical debts, even with insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And I think I'm never going to know for sure like what exactly happened that she died. But the way I feel about that is that that experience just wore her down to the point that her body gave up on her. And when I say it happened over the course of a couple of days, when I found out that basically, you know, I found out that things had hit this crisis point with her health when she asked me for help because she had fallen down and couldn't get back up again. And just, you know, sort of in the hallway of our apartment right outside the bathroom. And so I tried my best to help her, but she really could not do much of anything for herself. Fortunately, we had some neighbors who we knew well and were friendly with, and they were able to help us out just as far as meeting her needs at that moment. And the few of us, me and some of the other neighbors who lived around our unit in the same complex, we were coordinating with each other to keep an eye on her while she was, you know, sick. We didn't know how sick she was initially, but we were really concerned pretty much from the start. When you see someone who's fallen down and can't get back up on their own, you've got to be concerned about that. And we all tried to convince her to go to the hospital, but she did not want to go. This is, I think, about four or five of us, all told, basically relaying the same message. Just being really concerned and, you know, not being competent to give her the care she needed and trying to make her see that. But I asked her just point blank at one point in all this, Jessica, why don't you want to go to the hospital? And she, by this time, she was not very lucid. She was hallucinating, actually, at points. And she told me, but she was very clear about why she didn't want to go to the hospital. She was very precise, actually. She told me, her exact words to me were, I've got $50,000 in medical debt, Pete. And that's the reason why she didn't want to go. She thought people were in the room toward the end there who were not there. But she remembered exactly how much medical debt she had.
So she made a choice about her health care that was based on money. Is that right?
More or less that, yes. And we, myself and the neighbors and friends who are helping us and involved in this, we you know, did our best to kind of force the issue. You know, we did call EMS a couple times, three times total, if you want to count the one where she was dead. And when she came, she was able to pass an orientation check for mental health status, and they were not able to transport her involuntarily, even though I explained about the hallucinations and everything else. So what that adds up to me, as far as that experience goes, of course, it's very traumatic, and it's very confusing, because you're not prepared for that. If you're not a professional, you know, who deals with this kind of thing, you are not prepared for that when it just kind of falls in your lap right where you live. But I would describe all that as being just one of the most, I think, disempowering experiences I've had. Just in the sense of, like, knowing how bad things are getting and not being able to do much of anything to stop it. You just have to kind of hope that if you keep at it, then, you know, you can change that situation or convince someone to help themselves.
You became, I imagine this experience politicized you, and the Occupy movement suggested what people could do. Is that right?
In my case, I would say yes. I wouldn't claim to speak for everybody, but the way I remember reacting to the Occupy movement when it came along, and that was, I would say, as you said at the beginning of the show here, my real, like, not necessarily my politicization, but my sort of sense that, you know, activism and protest and organizing were the only alternatives to what was going on. That was, I'd become so frustrated with, you know, the Democratic Party and with just in general, you know, chiefly the federal government to me at that time, but government at all levels seeming inability to address the needs that were becoming so apparent during the so-called Great Recession. So when Occupy came, to me that it felt like what I had been waiting for longer than I realized, I would say. Just here was something new, and here was something where you could see just thousands upon thousands of people in New York City at first, and then ultimately here in Portland like 2-3 weeks later. Just thousands of people who seemed to feel the way I felt, just in the sense of being so frustrated with the inefficacy and corruption and lack of justice coming out of the financial crash in 2008. And if we talk about the specific experience with Jessica's death as a politicization, I would say that it is, but that my perspective had already been pretty well shaped by Occupy and by the organizing and activism I did afterwards in the sort of intervening period there. But I would say that it's different when you experience something like what happened with Jessica, which is that, like, you know, it's one thing to get fed up with what you see on the news and what you read on the internet and, you know, about the sort of, like, big abstractions of things. But when I look back on what happened with that, and, you know, there's more to come on that story, I might add. When I look back at what happened there, I think of it and I say, well, you know, this is what, when we talk about the struggle, those of us who are involved on the left and organizing, we talk about the struggle. This is what the struggle is to me, you know? It's people getting beat around by things outside of their control and trying to lean on each other and organize some way to push back against that. Like, you know, me and my neighbors tried to do with this box that Jessica's financial and medical situation had put her in.
What you're saying is that politics and action are tied up with personal experiences that tie people together. Is that right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And to me, like, you know, I know it. We say this a lot, and it becomes something of a cliche. But this to me is a great example of how the personal is political, and vice versa. Just say, if we get too abstract with things, if we lose touch of, like, the basics of why we're doing these things, it's to prevent unnecessary suffering, to me. That's how I see it, you know? That there is no excuse for unnecessary suffering to be happening. if we have good ideas or proven concepts, even from other nations and so on, that we know can help.
Are there perhaps examples of things that you may have been active in or that you have personal experience with that seem to be doing the right kind of thing? And I guess it might be too little, but could you give me your thoughts on that?
Well, if we talk about sort of specific ideas or campaigns or organizations in relation to the story, I think, you know, universal healthcare is clearly something where, like, I believed very much in universal healthcare before this happened, but it just drives it home to me, which is that it puts it in such a stark narrative of literally what happened here was that someone refused help because of money, because they didn't think they could afford the help. And what does that say about our society, that someone should be afraid to ask for help when it's available to them because they've been taught you pay your debts, and they've been taught, you know, debt is shameful, and they've been taught that, you know, like, healthcare is something that people deserve and earn rather than a human right. Like, it got down to, like, she did not feel like she would be, or this is how I interpret what she told me anyway, that she would be irresponsible to get in another ambulance, that she would be, you know, she was worried about, like, the financials instead of about, like, the immediate health crisis, or wouldn't say to the total exclusion of her current health. But I think that the strain of, like, the idea of adding to that mountain of debt, which, you know, I'm not sure how she was ever going to pay that back. I think that the psychological strain of that may have helped her to deny how serious her condition was, even with a bunch of people telling her, we think you need to go to the hospital. She said at a few points, you know, I just need to rest, you know. And you could read a lot into that, but when you put those two things together, that's what that makes me think, or that's how I would respond to what you asked. And it goes to so many different places. And, you know, Jessica's death actually was just the beginning of this story in some ways. I mean, it was a very... I could spend a lot of time just talking about that and what that taught me. But the thing that happened after was that, you know, I was in pretty consistent contact with the property management company, which is called Capital Property Management, who managed that apartment complex. And at first, the representative I was dealing with seemed very sympathetic and willing to be supportive and flexible. So we, in some ongoing conversations, she asked me, do you think you want to leave this place, or do you think that you want to put a new roommate in? And I think we probably both know, Fernando, that it's pretty expensive to get into a new place in Portland, and it's not the easiest thing to do. We've got one of the lowest rental vacancy rates in the whole country. And if you're working off relatively limited budget, you know, then your options are very constricted as far as housing, if you're looking for shared housing in this town. So, you know,
so the lease was in yours and Jessica's name.
Yes, it was. And, you know, I had some people suggesting, friends and family, that, you know, maybe it's not very healthy for you to stay there. And I was like, you know, you're probably right. It isn't. But, you know, look at how much it's going to cost to move to a new place. And so that was, in a way, I was like modeling the same thinking that Jessica was in that moment, you know? Like, putting the sort of, like, you know, financial stress first in my mind. And anyway, so they told me, yeah, okay, well, we'll get you the forms that you need to add a roommate, and you can let me know when I, you know, when you find somebody. I was like, okay, great. Never did get those forms, by the way. But anyway, sort of in some ongoing conversations, because her family had been in and out to remove her things, and, you know, there was all that to handle. But eventually, you know, when all of that died down, I was... got in touch with this person because I'd had a look inside the room that would be opening up, and as I noticed that it would need to be repaired and fixed up. So I asked them, long story short, I gave a call to that person and asked, well, can we talk about doing a bit of remodeling in there, you know, so I can actually get someone in there? And I never did receive a call back about that one either. But I do know that the next day that person sat down and wrote out a no-cause eviction letter to me.
So you were given notice that you were being evicted.
Yeah, for requesting something that I believe to have been within my rights as a tenant.
So what you've, Pete, what you've tied in here, issues of health care, obviously, there's Health Care for All Oregon is an organization mm-hmm. that's been fighting for single-payer health care now for a number of years. Mm-hmm. We have 15 now where yeah. mm-hmm. people are trying to raise the minimum wage, and we have the Portland Solidarity Network that tries to prevent people from being evicted and becoming homeless. They take up any number of issues like this, but they all seem to be disjointed.
Mm-hmm.
People are doing good, but there just doesn't seem to be enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're talking about organizations. I think that a lot of them are only a few years old. I mean, Healthcare for All Oregon is certainly older than 15 now and is older than Portland Solidarity Network. But a lot of these innovative community-oriented groups that we've seen spring up, like 15 now and Right to Dream 2 and Portland Solidarity Network, are pretty recent inventions. And to me, that is sort of a hopeful sign that, you know, we may in fact be seeing only the beginning of what these organizations are able to accomplish, and we can think about how much they've accomplished already. That, like, these conversations are further in the direction of solutions like single-payer healthcare and a living minimum wage than they were even, you know, a year or two ago. Occupy was only about three and a half years ago now. So a lot's gone on since then, and, you know, if we continue to see success from organizations like Portland Solidarity Network, for example, then we can maybe see that they spawn some new chapters and that it proliferates and that more people are able to be helped and supported in that way. But I think that all starts with people being willing to, if they have been victimized by a corporate entity like this, by, you know, sort of the indifference of capitalism, if you will, I think it's important that people stand up and be vocal about that if they're able to. Name names and, you know, call for help if they can get it. And Portland Solidarity Network is organizing around that sort of ideal, I think, you know, saying that just from admiring them from afar, really. But when it gets down to it, when I think back on that experience dealing with capital property, as far as their, you know, I would argue blatantly deceitful treatment of me. I was talking with one of my neighbors there, and he told me that another unit had opened up in the apartment. And I was like, well, how much are they renting that for? This is after they had already issued that eviction. And he quoted me a figure that was like $25 a month, more than I had been paying. That adds up to $300 a year, and that is the level of petty greed we're talking about here. And some people criticize Portland Solidarity Network's, for example, confrontational methods, but I'm not sure what else we can expect to do at this point. Considering that I consulted with legal advice, I was told that I would not be able to prove retaliation in court. And I was fortunate in that I was able to find a new place for not that much more money, and that I was able to, you know, not involve them in affecting my housing status, and that I was able to not be homeless. When it gets down to it, that gets back to where we started, which is the background that I come from. The difference between me being homeless, because if you give me a 60-day eviction notice 10 days before rent is due, like that happened, and I don't have some privilege to fall back on, I'm probably on the streets. So, you know, that is the difference to me. Like, you know, this is an experience where it's like, I work with homeless people as a grad student in social work. I experience this. I'm like, this is exactly how people become homeless. This is exactly it right now. And all for $300 a year. And just to get out of doing work that they were going to do anyway if they wanted to kick me out.
I share a similar experience, just briefly. I had heart surgery, and the first thing I thought of when I woke up from my operation was the 50,000 people that die in the United States a year who don't have adequate health care or don't have health care. And the thing is that it angered me so much, and I see that we need to do something about this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't think there's really any alternative because, you know, if we don't, any improvement that has happened, I think, is a result of us doing something.
Well, thank you, Pete. This has been Labor Radio, and Fernando Gappasine and Elizabeth Ann McDonald, and we'll see you next week.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening Tuesday the 21st from 5:30 to 7:45 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Portland, and Sunday the 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the North Portland Library. The Portland Renters Assembly is a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right. There'll be a chance for individuals to tell their stories about skyrocketing rents, no-cause evictions, dubious fees, and other kinds of exploitation carried out in the name of rent. There'll be childcare, snacks, and a chance to get connected to resources for moving forward together. For more information about the Portland Renters Assembly, go to kboo.fm and click on the right side for community events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul.